Welcome to REI Marketing Secrets, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of real estate investor marketing. Your host is Trevor Oldham, founder of Podcasting You, and each week we bring you exclusive interviews with successful real estate investors who have mastered the art of marketing their real estate businesses. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out in the real estate industry, this podcast is your gateway to unlocking the secrets behind effective real estate investor marketing. Get ready to elevate your marketing game and take your business to new heights.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the REI Marketing Secrets podcast. Today on the show, we have Brian Burke. Brian is the president and CEO of Praxis Capital, a vertically integrated real estate private equity investment firm, which he founded in 2001. Brian has acquired over $800 million worth of real estate over a 30-year career, including over 4,000 multifamily units and more than 700 single-family homes, with the assistance of proprietary software that he wrote himself. Brian has also subdivided land, built homes, and constructed self-storage, but he really prefers to reposition existing multifamily properties. Additionally, he is also the author of The Hands-Off Investor and is a frequent public speaker at real estate conferences and events nationwide. Brian, super excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Trevor. I'm excited to be here.
And Brian, going back to, say, in your early years, like, why did you decide to say, hey, I want to start investing in real estate? If you could think back 20, 30 years, what got you into the game all the way back then?
Well, I think it was a combination of two things. One is, what choice did I have? I didn't really have a lot of skills in doing much of anything. Of course, when I started, I was 20 years old, just not too long out of high school. And I think my first business was selling pomegranates on a card table on the intersection by my grandmother's house that were grown on her tree in the front yard. So I guess I figured I had to be in some kind of a business. And from everything I had heard and read and all the books and everything else was that real estate was the way that most wealth was made. So I figured that sounds good to me. I'll start investing in real estate. And made my first real estate investment when I was 20. And it was a terrible experience. So I was therefore hooked.
Yeah, what happened with that first experience? Was it the tenants? Was it the termites? Was it the toilets? Which one of those was it?
Oh, it was every one of those things, believe me. Yeah, it was everything. Everything that could go wrong, of course, went wrong. And at the end of the day, when I finally sold that property, I had it as a rental for a couple of years. And when I finally sold it, I think I either broke even or maybe had, like, I don't know, a few hundred dollars loss or a few hundred dollars profit. I mean, it was certainly wasn't worth the effort. But it was a really, really incredible opportunity to learn a lot about what I didn't know and learn about how difficult the business is so that I don't take it too lackadaisically. I had to take it seriously if I was going to be successful. And that was a good time to learn that.
So now that you got your start into real estate, maybe the first deal didn't go out as good as you wanted, but you got your teeth into it. As I say, the first deal is always the hardest. And then now, as you've been building your company, why multifamily? Why multifamily over mobile home parks, over self-storage, over hot thing of short-term rentals, midterm rentals? Why did you decide to go with multifamily and build your company around that?
Because over the years, I've had the good fortune of acquiring almost $1 billion in real estate. It's like almost, I'm coming up on almost 800 properties. And in amongst that, I've done almost all of those things that you mentioned. And what I found is that I was best at multifamily. It would have all kinds of challenges that were steep obstacles when I tried to stray off the path into some other kind of asset class like hospitality and vacant land and development. Some went well and some maybe not as well, but they were all very difficult and challenging and seemed like they took forever. Yet multifamily is been one that, despite the fact that, of course, it has its challenges and we've had our deals that struggle like everybody else, that produced much better results for me and for our investors for every unit of risk and for every unit of time. And I've just found that that's what we're really good at. And you might as well stick to what you found you're best at and just stay that course.
Yeah. And I think that's a good example. I find that sometimes you might see an operator where they go into multifamily and then the next year they might be in an RV park and then the next year they might be in laundromat space. And to me, it's like, how much am I going to trust this operator where someone like yourself, they've been in the business over 20 years, you rode through 08 and obviously more recently you know, in the last year or so, you've seen a lot of these multifamily operators really get hammered with their bridge debt, with a lot of them not buying any interest rate caps and different things like that. But for your company as a whole, obviously going through 08, and then now there's a ton of syndicators that got started the last 2 or 3 years, where almost you could go buy any property. You put 50K into the deal, you know, you're giving someone that 2x equity multiple after a year or two, where I feel like in the last, you know, maybe year or so, as interest rates have risen, maybe a little steeper than what the majority of us expected. How has your company sort of navigated those waters in the multifamily space, just given that maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it was almost like anyone could buy a multifamily property and make some money on it?
And that was the very thing that played right into our strategy, is anybody could buy multifamily. And when it gets like that, that's the time to sell them all the multifamily you have. So over the last couple of years, we sold almost everything. We started selling in 2021. And by the middle of 2022, we had sold 3/4 of our portfolio. It's over 3,000 units we sold. And the beauty of real estate is there's always an opportunity somewhere. And that's why you'll see a lot of people kind of drifting from one asset class to another. And today it's self-storage, and tomorrow it's hotels, and the next day it's offices. That's the beauty of real estate, is that you can always find opportunity. And that's great if you're using your own money, but when you're investing someone else's money, you better stick to where your core competency lies. And again, we found multi to be our core competency. And I think that played really well into kind of the recent turn of events, where we were very entrenched in this industry. We could see the signs and signals very clearly. And it was telling me, while it was telling everybody else get in, it was telling me get out. And that's exactly what we did. And now it's been over 2 years since I've bought a multifamily asset. And I couldn't be happier that it's been that long. And I suspect it may be a while longer before we actually make another acquisition. I just don't think the market's ready for that yet. And we're just waiting for it to get there and come to us. I don't have to chase opportunity in every sector. I've been doing this long enough that now I don't have to do anything and I can be just fine. So we only buy when it makes sense to buy. And so that's also been another leg of our strategy, is standing down while we watch values fall down.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, where I think a lot of, again, operators where maybe the more shady ones, they're coming through and they're just trying to collect the fees, maybe an asset management fee, maybe a finder's fee, whatever that may be. So it's nice to see that your company's coming in. You're not necessarily like trying to pump out a new property every single month just to have a property. And I think an example of that is the company, they foreclosed out in Texas. It might've been Houston. It was $300 or $400 million was wiped out of there. So that's good to see. But just curious, down the road, let's say you do find a multifamily property, whatever it may be, say 50, 100, 200, 300 units. How do you really find your investors? They're going to partner alongside you and invest in that deal. Are you finding them through doing like podcasts like this and promoting yourself through that? Is it maybe being an influencer, say on LinkedIn or a similar platform? Just curious to see like how you find investors, or are you just going like, say, more the institutional route, maybe bringing endowment money over toward you?
Yeah, we've certainly done some institutional work, but that's not really our core focus. We're a boutique investment firm that caters to high net worth individuals and family offices. And that's where our capital comes from, more so than from institutional partners. Although we've certainly gone down that road before, and we could do it again if the situation were right. But in the earlier years, I've been doing this for 34 years. And in the earlier years, we used to seek out investors by any means possible. But nowadays, I don't do that anymore. So I don't find my investors. They find me. We've been around long enough that people know who we are and what we do. We've been around long enough. I have 2,000 investor relations people. Those are our investors who go out and tell their friends and their colleagues, hey, I've invested with these guys. It's been a great experience. You should invest with them. And so people come to us. And now we do zero marketing. I appear on these podcasts, I think mostly because I just enjoy talking about real estate. But I suppose at the end of the day, there's people that do find us by hearing us for the first time on a podcast like this. But really, I think as a business matures, it begins to grow organically. And we've always grown by word of mouth and referrals. That's always been our primary model. But as the years tick on, that growth gets a lot faster than it does earlier on when you're really trying to build that investor base from nothing.
I think it's a good example and great answer there. You know, it's building up through that referral business. I mean, there's nothing better, especially as a investor company. You know, you want to get those referrals. If you're not getting referrals, something might be wrong. Maybe there's too many capital calls or something like that. Hopefully that's never the case. But with that said, like, let's say you find that deal in a year, hypothetically, a year from now. Do you even like have to market the deal? Or is it just like, hey, you're sending it out to your investor relations folks. They know that because just your track record. Or is it like, do you have to like sell them on the deal? How does that sort of look like when you want to come in? Or does the deal get fully funded in a day or two once you guys finally do find something?
Yeah, you know, we used to do single asset syndications where we would find a deal and we would raise money for the deal. And we'd show people, here's the property we're buying and this is the amount of money we're raising. And a lot of those raises were $5 to $10 million on average. And we would generally fill those up in a couple days. And we would do it by just sending out an email to our investor base. We've got another property. Here's the specifics. If you're interested, let us know. We'll send you the information. And we would send out the information and they could make soft commits. And usually a couple days later, we were fully funded. And then the problem that we had was we had this long line of people that missed out. They didn't get in. So we eventually shifted over to a fund model where we would raise money for a fund with a strategy. And the strategy would be when we're going to acquire class A and B multifamily over 100 units in the southeastern US, blah, 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 you know, whatever the particular model was. And that's generally our model, newer multifamily properties, mostly in the southern half of the US. And we would send out a notice to our investors that we're opening up this fund. And I think the last fund we did, we raised close to $50 million in about 6 weeks. Maybe it was a little less than that. And we haven't had to raise since. Now, this says two things. One is it says that we've done a really good job over the years. We've produced really good results for our investors. That's made people happy. And as a result, they invest repeatedly with us. A large, large portion of our capital comes from repeat investors, which is great. It's a great spot to be. So it says that, but it also says that around that time, the real estate market was really hot. Everybody wanted in and investors were investing in every opportunity they could get their hands on. So we can't get complacent as an operator and say that today I could launch a $50 million offering and fill it in 2 or 3 weeks. Because I don't know that that would actually happen. And not because of anything that we've done, but the market has changed. It's different. People might not have as much affinity towards real estate as they did a couple of years ago. There might be a lot of passive investors that invested with other operators that have had challenges such as capital calls, maybe some mortgage defaults. The list goes on and on. And that creates wounds that create scars that heal very slowly. And I think down the line, I would expect that we would raise capital slower than we have in the last 5 or 6 years. It's going to be more like it was 10 years ago than it like it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And thinking about, I know you mentioned like the fund model. I'm invested in a couple of deals. Some they have four properties in it. Some of them, I think one has two. And then you have like a single asset allocation. There's one property in Texas I'm invested in. What's your preference on that? Do you like more of that fund model? I know as me as an investor, I almost think of it like an index fund. Per se, if you're investing in the stock market, instead of me investing in one specific stock, I'm investing in these four different properties. Yeah, the fees might be, yeah, they might be a touch higher, you know, maybe 0.25%. But if one property defaults, or the one I'm thinking of, I'm invested in a triple net lease deal. So there's four different tenants. One of the tenant moves out, they have a vacancy. I'm not going to get that cash flow. I invested in that deal strictly the cash flow, not a ton of appreciation in a corporate grade A tenant. But curious what your thoughts are on the fund model versus that single asset allocation.
Yeah, I prefer the fund model both as an investor and as a sponsor. As a sponsor, a fund gives us more purchasing power. It gives us a stronger negotiating position when we're acquiring property. It's easier for us to administer because we only have one main accounting vehicle as opposed to all these different ones with different tax returns and everything else. It does consolidate a lot of that, which is really nice. For the investor, it's kind of like the same reason why you would invest in apartments versus single family homes, right? If one apartment's vacant, you still got 99 other apartments, but in a single family home, if it's vacant, it's vacant. Fund is kind of the same way. I don't care how good an operator is or how long they've been in this business. Everybody has deals that struggle eventually. And so ends up happening is you've got like 9 deals that are doing great, 1 deal that's not doing so great, which is typical. And you got 9 sets of investors who are really happy, and you got 1 set of investor that's like, you guys are terrible. What's wrong with you guys? Now, if they're invested in across multiple offerings, then they see what's going on big picture and they don't feel that way. But if their only investment with you is in that one asset that isn't doing so great, then those investors are kind of like, hey, what's going on? The fund smooths all that out. So the good deals and the mediocre deals end up in the same vehicle. It's not luck of the draw. I know investors like to think that we're so skilled that we could pick the winners and not end up investing in the one that struggles. But the reality is you can't. You don't know which one's going to be the difficult one. So if you're investing in a fund, then you get to blend all of that out. It's less risk for you. So I think passive investors especially should be looking for ways to minimize single points of failure. So that means if you invest in a fund, you've got multiple properties. If the fund has multiple locations, then you don't have one single location that's a risk. If there was an economic collapse in a city, for example, it's not like it took down all your assets. That's just one of them. If you invest in funds across a variety of sponsors, you eliminate single sponsor risk. Just anything you can do to spread your risk around will give you an investment in real estate as a whole versus an investment in Marvin Gardens. So then Marvin Garden burns down and now your investment went to crap.
Yeah, I think that would be, I can definitely see that. I think too, going back to that, if we could all pick winners, you'd think we'd all try to get like 3x equity multiple in 5 years, triple our money. If we could all do that. But then, speaking of the properties that you're going out and buying, are you going, primarily in like the Southwest? So like if we're talking like Texas, Florida, Georgia, Texas is pretty far west from Florida. But yeah, just curious, like the locations you are in, because I've seen some really good deals come across, but they're in California. And it just worries me. It just really worries me investing in those states. Like for me, I'm primarily in Texas and Kentucky. I think Arkansas, West Virginia, more of your, if you're looking at your political map, more of your red states, more than your blue states, just as they're more landlord friendly than in New York. We're definitely more tenant friendly than we are landlord friendly. It could take a couple of months to evict someone. Just curious, like which part of the country your company really specializes in investing in?
Well, in my 34 years, I've owned in California, I've owned in New York, and I've owned in a lot of places in between. So that's a pretty national footprint. Our current focus right now is on the southern half of the U.S., not California, certainly not New York. But right now we own in Arizona, Georgia, and Alabama. But we've had extensive holdings in Texas, Florida, but now we've just, as I mentioned earlier, we've sold 3/4 of our portfolio. So all that's left is in those states I mentioned. But our acquisition targets would be anything from Arizona to Florida and as far north as like Carolinas and Tennessee and anything in between.
Let's say now you have someone that's out there, if they're listening, they like those geographical locations, they've liked what they've heard. Now that they've, let's say they become an investor of yours, they've invested with your company. For that potential listener that wants to invest with your company, they say, hey, this all sounds great. How does that sort of that client communication sound like on the back end? We've heard horror stories of you invest in a deal and it's super hard to track down the operator. Or maybe it's a capital raiser that got you into the deal, that extended arm, and then you're having a hard time to hear from them. Luckily for me, the deals I'm in, I either get quarterly or monthly reporting, and they've been consistent for the last couple of years doing that. But for your company itself, like how often do you communicate with the clients? Or let's say something comes up, I don't know, renovations are taking longer, the contractor up and left, and now all of a sudden the renovations, what you thought were going to take 6 months are going to take 9 months. Do you communicate that with your investors? Or do you just do that in like a single monthly or one-off or even all hands call? I've seen investors do where, they just bring everyone on a webinar or a Zoom call, explain what's going on. Just curious what that looks like from your company and on that client communication aspect of it.
Yeah, it's really not uncommon for especially newer and first time sponsors to suffer from massive communication failures and complications. And I hear that a lot. It's probably one of the chief investor complaints you'll hear out there in this industry is lack of communication, especially when things aren't going right. When things are going wrong, there's like this course that I always talk about how it's going to go, because people will say like, oh, I think that something's going wrong with this deal. And it's like, okay, here's what's going to happen next. You're going to send an email and they're going to put you off. And then when you ask again, they're going to completely ignore you. And then there's like this whole path that seems to happen. And if you've been in business long enough, chances are that company isn't going to have that same problem, because you don't last in this business by ignoring your investors. Your investors are your lifeblood. The capital they contribute is the only thing that keeps you going. And if you don't communicate with them, then that's going to be the end of the road. You're going to spend all your time looking for new investors instead of cultivating the relationships you already have. So I'm a big believer in reporting and communications. I remember one time somebody that's very active passive investor and had started a group that supports passive investors had once written an article about us, calling us the gold standard for investor reporting, and asked if they could publish our reports in their stuff so that they could show other sponsors how they're supposed to do it. Of course, we said no. Go let them invent their own proprietary methods of communication. I fully support growth in this industry and people doing a better job, but I don't need everybody out there just copying our stuff. We tend to issue extraordinarily detailed reports. I think our last quarterly, and we do them quarterly, but our last quarterly report for one of our funds was something like 15 pages long or something. I mean, it was really, really extensive. And most of that's narrative. We talk about all sorts of things that's happening at the property level, the fund level, the macroeconomic picture, just all sorts of information. We provide comparisons between projected performance and actual performance. And when things aren't going according to plan, we say things aren't going according to plan. And here's why. And here's what we're going to do about it, if we can do anything at all. Like right now, things aren't going according to plan because the market's terrible. And there's nothing we can do about that. We can't do anything about rising insurance rates. We can't do anything about runaway interest rates. We can't do anything about the fact that no one's out there acquiring anything and the market's come to a standstill. We can't fix those things. But what we can do is we can show our investors how we were prepared for that already and why that isn't a big risk to us and why impacts to property cash flow could mean massive trouble or might not mean massive trouble, depending upon how you structured the deal to begin with. And then we point out how we structured it to make sure that these kinds of things weren't a massive impact to us. So we don't want investors hearing about things on the news. So when we've had like buildings burned down, it's like, you know, we send out an email like, hey, the building burned down yesterday and here's what we're going to do. And we've already hired a public adjuster and we're filing an insurance claim and so on and so forth. Because we don't want them to, somebody call up and say like, hey, I saw this newspaper article, you know, that mentioned the apartments we own burned down. Why didn't you tell me? We certainly don't want that. So always communicate the bad news, especially with investors, but also make sure you're communicating regularly with the good news.
Yeah, I think that's a good example. I think definitely having like, you know, not that everyone has to do a 15 page, but I mean, I guess if that's gold standard, that's what we should all be striving for. I know as myself as an investor, and hopefully most investors out there, they're getting into a deal, they're reading the PPM. So I mean, that's a lot more intense than the quarterly report that you're sending out. So that's great that you're doing that. But then let's say someone's in the audience, I guess they're trying to get over that last hump. You know, I know for me personally, your company sounds great. The track record speaks for itself, but just one last little bit of why should someone invest with your company over, say, another operator within the space?
Well, I think most people invest with us for a couple of reasons. One is because we've been around so long, we've proven that we know what we're doing. The second reason is we have a highly experienced team. Our senior leadership here has 106,000 units of multifamily experience. I don't think you can find that anywhere. Even if you went to Blackstone, you'd have to put together like a whole cadre of leadership team to add it all together to get to that. But here we've got four guys who are at the top of the leadership on operations here that over 100,000 units of experience. And that means a lot. I think the other thing is we prioritize risk over return. People don't invest with us because we're going to have the highest projected return. If that's what you're looking for, you're not going to find it here. And you're probably not going to find the actual performance that you're seeking with who you do choose, if that's your criteria. But we like to prioritize risk over reward. And that's worked well for us. In all the years I've been doing this, we've never lost a nickel of investor principal. And that's how many hundreds of millions that we've raised from investors. And we've never issued an unplanned capital call, knock on wood. So I think for those reasons, track record, experience, integrity, and just operational skill and structuring our deals to survive adverse market cycles by not taking on too much debt, not over-leveraging, having plenty of cash reserves, a deep balance sheet, and also a leadership team that doesn't have to transact just to keep the lights on are probably the reasons why we've been as successful as we have.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really like that risk versus reward. I know for me as an investor, it kind of scares me. Or sometimes I'll be speaking to someone, and they'll be like, the IRR will be like 45% per year. And we're talking maybe class A property. And I'm like, you know, that's terrifying for me, you know, where I'm just looking for a standard overall, you know, at the end of 5 years, 10 to 14%, maybe get a standard 8% pref, you know, just something simple like that. I know I run up when I see an investor give me a deal and it just sounds too good. Like one guy, he was promising like Christmas bonuses. Another guy, he was in an oil and gas field where there was like 200% carbon depreciation recapture. And I was like, that sounds way too good to be true. Unfortunately, his thing ended up being a Ponzi scheme. So it sounds too good to be true. I'm right there with you. I'd rather have a little bit less risk, be a little bit more standard than trying to jump for the fences. And again, we're talking like class A, maybe class D, class C, you know, heavy value add. Maybe you could get that at the end of the deal. But yeah, that all sounds great. And then Brian, last question of the day is for our audience is interested in learning more about you or learning more about your company, where can they find you?
They can find us on our website for Praxis Capital. The website is praxcap.com. It's praxcap.com. You can also find me on Instagram at Investor Brian Burke.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Brian. I'll make sure to include that on the show notes on our website. And thank you again for coming on to the show today.
Thanks for having me here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to the REI Marketing Secrets Podcast. Be sure to head on over to our website to check out the episode's full show notes. We'd love it if you would leave a review for us on iTunes. If you're interested in using podcast guesting to grow your real estate business, head over to podcastingyou.com. That's podcastingyou.com. We've helped over 400 real estate professionals secure more than 6,500 interviews. They're a podcasting booking agency that helps real estate investors appear on top-rated podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to REI Marketing Secrets Podcast and join us every week as we bring you invaluable insights from the brightest minds in the real estate investment industry. Let's uncover the marketing secrets together.